This is a cycling podcast at the 2025 Vuelta a España, proudly supported by Lloyds. Lloyds are the title sponsors of the Lloyds Tour of Britain Men, which is making its way from the east of England to South Wales this week. And we're doubling up because as well as our Vuelta coverage, we're also at the Lloyds Tour of Britain, making daily episodes from the race for the first time, thanks to sponsorship from Lloyds. Last year, Lloyds signed a multi-year partnership with British Cycling to support the sport from the elite level to grassroots, encouraging more people to discover the joy of cycling, whether for leisure, commuting or sport. And Lloyds is also supporting the Great Britain cycling team as official partners and sponsors. They've been in action at the recent UCI Road Paracycling World Championships and are competing in the UCI Mountain Bike World Championships right now. And very soon, we'll find out which riders have been selected for the UCI Road World Championships, which take place at the end of the month. That's when British Cycling will name the squad of riders who'll pull on the famous national team jersey featuring the Lloyds horse logo. Lloyds, there at every stage. Now it's time to join Daniel in Spain.
You are listening to the cycling podcast at the 2025 Vuelta a España, celebrating 10 years of the cycling podcast on the ground every day at the Grand Tours.
Buenas tardes, Brian, Nigo, tonight.
Buenas tardes, Daniel.
How are you doing, Brian? Brian, you could probably tell the listeners where I am. You could probably describe the scene. I don't know if the Zoom, if your view shows you enough of my surroundings, but I think you can probably hear a quintessentially Spanish scene. I'm surrounded by people sitting at cafes, bars, and also children playing football, which is something you very often see in Spain. But I'm in Corrales de Huelna. Brian, I'm certainly very close to where Juan Ayuso won the 11th stage of the Vuelta a España today. And I'm also, I would guess, within a couple hundred meters or so of the apartment where he occasionally, I don't think he lived there full time, but he certainly spent a lot of time here when he was riding as a junior. And he said in his press conference after the finish that he, yes, had an apartment near the finish line. So there you go.
Yeah, I mean, Daniel, no, I can't. First of all, I can't hear anything in the background. You're quite good at your sound control, aren't you, after all these years? But it looks like a housing estate, Daniel.
It's a sort of precinct, a bit of a shopping precinct. This is a town. Well, it was big crowds today, Brian, very big crowds. Yeah. And this is a town in Cantabria, one of the beautiful northern regions of Spain, with a rich cycling tradition. And Juan Ayuso's time at the Bathco Besaya team was sort of part of that. Well, that team was very much part of the fabric of this rich cycling heritage in this region of, or in this part of Cantabria. We've got a race here. There is a race up here called the Vuelta al Besaya, where Juan Ayuso, well, he won in 2019. He was second in 2020. The Circuito Montañés also often visits these parts, and the final climb that the race did today, where Ayuso launched his decisive move. So, yeah, there was a lot of enthusiasm for the race today, Brian, and that probably explains why there are still so many people milling around. What are we now, about an hour or so, a bit more than an hour after Juan Ayuso crossed the line
still
without
early.
Sputtering that.
Still early for Spanish evening too, isn't it?
It is, very early, very early. Brian, speaking of early, well, it wasn't that early this morning when we made our way to the start, because it was a late start, because it was a short stage today. Now, Brian, yesterday, of course, was a very eventful day on the Vuelta a España, controversial day with the pro-Palestine protest that caused the neutralization of yesterday's stage. It was still a developing story when we recorded last night, and I thought we would update the listeners first on some of the things that happened both last night and this morning. Where was I this morning? I was in Laredo on the Cantabrian coast. So, Brian, the first thing after we recorded last night we got was statements from the UCI and the Vuelta a España. Kind of similar statements, weren't they? Pretty similar.
To the effect, yeah.
Yeah. So I'll just read a couple of lines, or I might read the whole thing of the UCI statement. They firmly condemn the actions that led to the neutralisation of the 11th State of the Vuelta a España. UCI reiterates the fundamental importance of the political neutrality of sports organisations within the Olympic movement, as well as the unifying and pacifying role of sport. Major international sporting events embody a spirit of unity and dialogue, transcending differences and divisions. UCI affirms its commitment to political neutrality, expresses its solidarity and support for the teams and their staff, as well as the riders, who should be able to practice their profession and pursue their passion in optimal conditions of safety and serenity. No, there was no action announced. I'm not saying there should have been, but certainly worth noting. Brian, another thing that happened overnight was that we saw a bit more of what had caused the neutralisation yesterday. When I recorded last night with Larry, obviously I sort of described what I'd seen. I didn't see the sort of, well, the forcefulness of some of the protests and just how close they'd got to sort of breaking the barriers and spilling out into the road when the peloton approached on their first passage of the finish line yesterday. Brian, what else can I tell you? Well, from the start this morning in Laredo, we learned that Sylvain Adams, the boss of Israel Premier, he was not at the start this morning. We thought he might be, and we thought he might speak to us. He was out on his bike, as he often is, at Grand Tours. I learned this morning that Sylvain Adams spoke to David Lapartien, the UCI president, last night. Obviously, I don't know exactly what was said. Broadly, I'm led to believe that Lapartien was expressing his solidarity and his support. At the start this morning, the Israel bus was parked normally, Brian, in amongst all of the other buses. There were not a lot of police men, women around the bus. It looked like any normal start at a Grand Tour. There weren't a lot of protesters either around the bus or close to the start area. Oscar Guerrero, Spanish director sportif of the Israel Premier Tech team, well, he talked about what a traumatic experience yesterday had been for him, and he invited everyone to remember that over 100 families could potentially be put out of work if the team can no longer race, if the protesters kind of got their way, as he sort of put it, and they were sent home from races, and therefore the whole reason for them to exist was taken away. So that was said. And Brian, I spoke to various people this morning about the events of yesterday. I spoke first to another of the Israel Premier Tech direct sportifs, Daryl Impey. We're going to hear from him in a minute. We're then going to hear from Matteo Jorgensen. This order will make sense when you hear the interviews. We're then going to hear from Elia Viviani, who's one of the... Well, he was very much involved in some of the conversation before the stage yesterday about guaranteeing the safety of the riders. And then we're going to hear from Ben O'Connor, who we heard from last night, urging the UCI to take action and intervene, do something in this issue. Well, Darrell, obviously an eventful day yesterday. Just anything to update us on overnight? Obviously, last night there was talk about whether the team would carry on or not. Anything to update us on?
Oh, we weren't talking about if we're leaving or not. We're going to Madrid, so we as a team, we hear everyone what their thoughts are. Maybe people are talking about it, but us as a team, we committed to going all the way to Madrid. Simple.
And what's the feeling on the bus amongst the riders?
Oh, the guys are alright. I think they're concentrating on the bike race. Obviously, yesterday was a bit of a... wasn't a great day for us to deal with all that, but we got through that, and the team's quite resilient at the moment. We got Richardello sitting on 10th. He's doing really well. Ethan's had a great race, so we're trying to focus on that. We're trying to just focus on what we are. We're a sports team, and we're cracking on with it.
I know the riders. I mean, people have been talking in the peloton. The riders have had some blowback from their colleagues, and the environment is obviously not the nicest for them. Have you been subject to that as director sportifs as well? Other teams expressing their opinion that you should go home to you personally?
They haven't. No team's come to us and said, we think you should go home. I think everyone's got their opinions. A lot of them actually feel for us, to be honest. There's been quite a lot of support from the teams. Rider-wise, I think there's also been some riders supporting, some riders feeling a bit bad, but I think Jorgensen's been probably the most vocal in the CPO group. He's probably a guy who's had the most to say, so maybe you should go ask Jorgensen what he thinks. We ask answers. We're a sports team, and we don't mix politics, but obviously it's got to a point for him, so maybe he's got a lot more to say and add to this.
Jorgensen on the CPA group you're talking about privately, but he's been vocal.
Yeah, he's been pretty vocal, messaging the guys to leave. So I don't know who made him the king of the Welter, but maybe you should go ask him.
Yesterday, obviously, Sylvain was in the car. He's not here this morning. Was that a bit of a relief for you guys that he got to see what you've been experiencing? Were you happy that he was here to see it?
Yeah, I think so. I think Sylvain A wanted to come and see it. There's no doubt he knows there's a lot of things going on at the moment. And, you know, he came to feel it. Obviously, didn't enjoy seeing what was going on. But yeah, at the end of the day, he's also passionate about the team. He's passionate about who we are, how we race our bikes. And yeah, he enjoyed the race for what it was up until that point where it got neutralized.
I think as a rider, I have very little control over the situation and don't have much choice or power in this situation. So I don't really have solutions for you. I think I'm voicing my opinion where I can, and I think the rest is left to the people that can make decisions.
Darren Limpy, Israel Premier Tech Direct Sportif, said that you've been vocal about they shouldn't be here because it is endangering the rest of the peloton. Anything to say on that?
No, I don't really have a comment. I think those statements were made in a private group chat among riders, and I think that's pretty inappropriate for him to say it publicly to the media, and I think shows his standpoint quite clearly. So for me, I don't have a comment to make on it, and I've already voiced my opinion in the situations where I'm able to and where it will make an impact.
We can't go as a rider, on my point of view, versus our colleague. That is the main point. Then the valuation to continuing the racing or not is between Israel team, the riders, how they feel, because I feel sorry for them, to be honest, because I know how hard it's going through this stage in Vuelta, and they do it with people screaming on them like, really bad words. So it's hard for them, and I'm sorry for that, but it's their decision, and they need to talk with the organizer or this, but that can't come from the other riders, on my point of view.
Just one last thing. Do you think what's happened here will encourage the riders, more riders, to be as well informed as they can be and to read more about what's happening in the Middle East?
Yeah, absolutely. I think chaos, you know, create information, no? So for sure, if someone doesn't have really the specific information about the fact, after living in this situation, they will keep informed. Yeah, I think. Thank you.
I think in the end, it's they're kind of the ones who are meant to govern the sport. They're the rule makers, in essence. So, kind of the statement is kind of is a bit of a nothing kind of situation, because it was all up to the organisers that were there. You saw volunteers holding the barriers together. You know, they were just young men and women holding barriers against some people who want to cause chaos as part of the race. Didn't see anyone there from the UCI trying to find a solution of how do you fix the root cause. What other ways can we make sure that the race actually can continue in a good format? That's not really up for me to decide, but surely that's kind of where it should be at.
Brian, we're not going to spend too much time on this because I know a lot of listeners will be keen for us to get on to the events of the day on the road, and it was a very exciting day as well. So we may revisit the topic later in the episode, but anything you would like to say before we do talk about today's stage, based on what we've just heard?
Yeah, I mean, a conclusion that I guess sort of mimics also the difficulty I think all of us has in this situation. It's I think it's quite important also to remind ourselves that there is no perfect solution to this. There's not a solution where everyone really feels that they feel justly represented in whatever the outcome is. You know, there's not a scenario where I think the riders will feel perfectly safe because they don't know what's going to happen along the road. It's not 100% predictable, everything that happens, because of bike racing, being outside, moving, you know, towards Madrid, bigger cities. Hopefully they'll be better prepared. And then, I partly also agree with with the riders having the possibility to disagree, right? But I it's also problematic that, you know, trying to persuade riders to leave the race, or persuade riders to persuade the sports directors or general managers to leave the race, I think for me that's more a reflection of how stressful it has been for the riders, which I think is significant at this point.
Yeah. People might think it was salacious of us to, well, hear Dow MP invite us to go and speak to Matteo Jorgensen and then go and put Impey's words to Jorgensen, and you know, it was all, you could see that as fairly incendiary.
It's journalism, Daniel.
It is journalism. And also, it just underlines, I mean, yesterday as well, Brian, we've tried our best here to just say what we've seen. And yesterday, to be quite frank, I felt privileged to be here on the ground and just able to observe what was happening. And it was an important day for the Vuelta a España. It was an important day for professional cycling, and that was reflected in the sort of resonance of coverage about the Vuelta a España. You know, these protests and what happened yesterday was talked about in a lot of, all over the world, in various different news organs. So that felt, as I say, like a privilege, and we tried to just represent what we are seeing. And hearing from Impey there and hearing from Jorgensen just illustrates and underlines the fact that there is division in the peloton, and like you said, Brian, there are no easy solutions. Brian, on that note, as I said, we may return to that issue later on, but we will now talk about today's stage and what did happen on the road in today's Jamonómetro.
El Jamonómetro de Michele Pelacci.
Brian, how many hams for today's stage?
So I would actually say on the background or in the context of not being able to, or it was hard to really slice anything out of yesterday, I'm willing to give today a 4.
I would agree with you, Brian. I would agree with you. An absence of general classification action, shall we say, but nonetheless a cracking bike race for most of its duration, I would say. Brian, I am going to summarize, certainly, I would say, the first, I don't know, three quarters of what happened today, and then you may take over. So, stage 11 of the Vuelta a España, from Laredo to Los Corrales de Huelna, 144.9 kilometers. Brian, do you know what? At this point, I'm going to interrupt myself, and I've just realized there's one thing that it would be remiss of me not to do that we didn't do yesterday, because when we recorded last night, we didn't know what the general classification was because we were still waiting for the official timings. So before I go any further, I'm going to update you on the general classification going into today's stage. It was Vingegaard leading the Vuelta a España, Joao Almeida second, 50 seconds down, Tom Pidcock third, 56 seconds down, and then we had Torsten Train in fourth, and he was 1 minute 06 down, and then Felix Gal 2 minutes 17 down. So that clears that up to a certain extent. I'm not going to go into exactly who lost what yesterday, but that was the situation going into today's stage. What do we have on the route? We had the Puerto de Alisas, one of the most historic Vuelta climbs in the sense that it appeared in the very first edition in 1935. We know this is the 90th anniversary of the, what's the 90th anniversary of the creation of the Vuelta a España this year. We also have the Collada de Brenes, a legendary climb in the Vuelta al Besaya, which I mentioned earlier, won by Juan Ayuso in 2019. We had a DNS this morning, Sinue Fernandez of Burgos Biache, whose name so excited titillated Michele Pelacci when he was here. Brian, There was a protest in the neutralized zone. That was the most important protest, pro-Palestine protest we saw today, by the side of the road. It didn't converge, I don't think, onto the road, but it was certainly pretty loud and, fairly important. Before the Puerto de Alisas, the first big attack of the day, we had, 18 riders, including Kwiatkowski, Sheffield, Mads Pedersen, Marc Soler, we had Stefan Kung in there, David de la Cruz. As I say, 18 riders got away. Then on the Puerto de Alisas, Juan Ayuso was the catalyst for a large counter move, which would eventually result in the group at the head of the race, doubling in size. Some of the notable names in what did eventually become a 52-man group: Ayuso, Soler, Kung, Fortunato, Tejada, Markel, Bellocchi, EF Education First incidentally had four riders, Kwiatkowski, Sheffield already mentioned, Landa, Sudal also had four riders, Javi Romo of Movistar, they had five riders, Victor Campenaerts, Fabio Kristen, Santi Buitrago, Nico Dents, Pedersen, who I've already mentioned, Segert, who also had, Lotto also had four. And Brian, do you know who the only team who was not represented was?
I believe there were four teams ultimately not represented.
I think in this 52-man group, there was only one, I believe, and that was Israel Premier Tech.
Oh.
The best place rider on general classification in that group was Bruno Armirail. He was 8 minutes and 27 seconds down. With 63 kilometers to go, Ivan Cortina attacked, trying to get ahead before the final climb. In the peloton, we had Visma Liseberg pulling. Cortina was caught and on false flat, leading towards the bottom of the Collada de Brenes. The counter move started. Romo followed by Pedersen. They didn't get away. But eventually, a smaller group would detach itself. In that group were Hesman, Sheffield, Shaw, Pickering, Holland, and Gernalec. 4.5 kilometers from the top, the Collada de Brenes, James Shaw was the first rider to make a significant move. But the Ayuso group was coming, was approaching fast from behind, and they would eventually pass James Shaw and the rest of the satellite group, shall we say. And launched by Marc Soler at 2 kilometers from the summit, Ayuso went away. Javi Romo was the only rider who was able to follow him, despite a valiant attempt by Finley Pickering of Bahrain victorious. Romo and Ayuso were together over the top of the climb together. Brian, if I could hand over to you at this point, because I was with making pleasure. My way to the finish line.
With pleasure, Daniel. So the situation after Soler had launched Ayuso, so he went away with Romo. Bouygues Roland of Française des Jeux, FDJ, was chasing with 20 kilometers to go. Ayuso and Romo had a gap of 38 seconds, 5:43 to the Red Jersey group. Fast forward to 8 kilometers to go, trailing behind 16 seconds, Roland. At 1 minute, the Soler, Pedersen, Castillo group and the Red Jersey group was 6 minutes behind. So at this point, it was pretty obvious Roland was not going to catch Soler and Romo, and it was down to a, well, theoretically a two-man sprint, but it was a one-horse show, and Ayuso won his second stage in this Vuelta.
He duly dusted Javi Romo. And, well, behind Brian, I was certainly surprised at how close the chasing group, well, it was a slightly fractured chasing group, but how close a lot of riders got.
Campenaerts had jumped that group, hadn't he? And he just inched himself into fourth, and Mads Pedersen coming in fifth right behind him.
And they were just 17 seconds down. So they did get very close in the end. The general classification group, well, you have to go way down to 43rd place. They were led in by Ben Tulett of Visma Liseberg. No significant attacks in that GC group. It was a case of, well, everyone sort of resting up, I suppose is the wrong word. I'm sure it was a hard day on the bike. But we know we've got the Angliru coming tomorrow.
Well, it's worth mentioning one significant change in the GC, Daniel, and that is Bruno Armirail taking a huge jump in the GC to sixth overall.
Guillaume Martin would be proud. Brian, also a significant DNF we learned of after the finish. That was Esteban Chavez of EF Education. Easy post. It's not been a happy Vuelta a España for him. just going to run down general classification. Well, it's the same as it was going into today's stage. So Vingegaard leads 50 seconds over Almeida. Pidcock on 56 seconds. Then we've got Trine on 1 minute 06. Felix Gaut on 2:17 in the points competition. Good day for Mads Pedersen. We're going to hear from him in just a second. His lead is now very commanding indeed. 61 points over Ethan Vernon. Jay Vine still leads the King of the Mountains competition convincingly. And Giulio Pellizzari still leads Riccitello of Israel by 27 seconds in the white jersey competition. Brian, let's hear, as promised, from Mads Pedersen on a good day as far as the points competition is concerned, but another stage that he might have thought he could have won, would have won in other circumstances. We're also going to hear from a very exhausted Finley Pickering, and we're going to hear from another rider who made the break, but actually I've not mentioned thus far, Eddie Dunbar of Jayco Alula. Of course, double stage winner in the Vuelta last year.
It's never working well when there's 50 guys in a group like this. You know, it's so many different races in one race. You saw before the bonus sprint, Movistar, they started to attack because for sure they wanted to have a head start on the climb. And we wanted to have it all together for the sprint. So it's so many races in one race. And then, you know, for us, it was also like, yeah, but with Ayuso and all these climbers, why should we work all the way to the climb? So we were sitting on, and then we are sitting on, other riders are sitting on. So 50 riders is actually never nice to be in a breakaway with. Yeah, right now it's all about getting as many points as possible. Because, you know, on a day like tomorrow, Jonas have a high chance of winning the race, and that means 30 points for him. So it's nice to put some points in the bank account today. We're getting closer and closer, you know. Now, today we showed that the Lex is definitely there. So we can believe that we can win these hard mountain days as well. Today we are 17 seconds behind the winner, so it's not that far. So, yeah, it's still far to Madrid, and we keep dreaming.
Finley, how are you feeling after, well, big day out and a great ride?
Yeah, I mean, I feel good, but you always want to win, not, you know, try your best and come wherever place I came, but that was my best today, and yeah. I tried my hardest, and in the end when they were attacking, I felt like I had nothing, but you just have to get on with it.
You obviously, well, you started this Vuelta a España without any boxer shorts. Here you are. I mean, the fact that you didn't have an ideal preparation for this Vuelta, have you paid for it a little bit, and could that have been the difference today?
Yeah, I mean, maybe I could have gone to altitude, maybe I could have done motor pacing, but you're always wiser in hindsight, and I'm here, I'm trying my best, so I have to be content with that. And maybe next year I'll get a bit closer to a stage win. And also, there's still, how many stages? 9 stages? Still 9 opportunities to win. I mean, okay, some of the stages do not suit me at all, but there's still a chance. You have to buy a lottery ticket to win the lottery.
And just finally, is it also about putting yourself in the shop window, or is that all sorted now?
I don't know. I'm just the rider. You'll have to ask my agent if you want any contract business. But I just want to say, like, I'm grateful for Bahrain obviously putting me in this race and believing in me and giving me the opportunity today. So yeah, I have to thank them a lot.
Well, Eddie, you got in the break. Just talk us through sort of when you got to the last climb. What was the plan and what happened from then?
Yeah, finally, it only took me 12 stages to get up the road, but yeah, I had a good feeling today. But yeah, in a group of 45, it's just it's a bit of luck, you know. Obviously, I was on my own up there. We've lost a few guys, so it's a bit difficult to have numbers in a breakaway. But I think we made the best of a scenario we were in there. And yeah, I mean, I would have preferred if it finished on the climb for sure, with the way I was feeling. But it's positive for the next few days.
And obviously, everyone knew that Juan Ayuso was in that group. And I guess you all expected an attack from him, and you probably expected the result we got.
Yeah, obviously in the end I didn't realise the gap was coming down that quick, but it was a pretty big road, and when Pedersen got back to our group, he really injected a bit of pace into the group, which we probably needed. And yeah, I think the gap was only about 15 seconds or something in the end. So yeah, I said we came close, but yeah, impressive by Uso.
We obviously didn't see, well, the cameras weren't on you all the time. What was the collaboration like in that group? And could you have caught the two out front?
Oh, we all collaborated together for sure, but I think we had a couple of Movistar, and we had Marc Soler there as well, and they'd done a brilliant job for their teams behind, disrupting the chase, as anyone would, a few riders up the road, so fair play to them. It paid off, and yeah, as you said, that's cycling, isn't it? You're never going to get everyone on the same page to work together, and yeah, you just have to go with it.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, Cycling Podcast Team Car, the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, to remind me to tell you that this episode is sponsored by NordVPN, the virtual private network to keep yourself safe and secure whenever you're online, whether you're at home or on holiday or travelling for work, as Daniel and I are doing this week. I'm going to be on the road at the Lloyd's Tour of Britain. Daniel's over there in Spain, of course, and this is where a NordVPN subscription really comes into its own, because you can switch it on your phone, laptop, tablet, however you're browsing the internet, and make sure that your private data is safe and secure. The most important things to protect, of course, are your online identity, passwords, bank account details, things like that. And a NordVPN account gives you premium cyber security for the price of about a cup of coffee a month. You can use one NordVPN account on up to 10 devices, so no matter how you're browsing the internet, you can keep all of that data safe and secure when you're connecting up to hotel Wi-Fi or public hotspots, or even tethering to your mobile phone to connect to the internet. NordVPN's threat protection also protects you from viruses, malicious malware, and phishing sites. And there are loads of other benefits too, such as switching your location to another country to enable you to carry on watching your favorite sporting events or shows on whichever streaming services you are signed up to. Now, as a Cycling Podcast listener, you can get a great discount on a NordVPN plan by going to nordvpn.com/TCP. That link will give you an extra 4 months for free on top of a 2-year plan, and there's no risk either, because there's a 30-day money-back guarantee. So go to nordvpn.com/TCP and try it risk-free today.
Well, Brian, Juan Ayuso, the redemption song of Juan Ayuso. Did he need a redemption song? What today certainly was, I would suggest, was fairly predictable, in the sense that, well, I mentioned briefly his connections with this part of the world, and it was a stage that ultimately suited him, didn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's never a foregone conclusion, especially, you know, this is a grand tour, and there are no, the manuscript is not written on beforehand, and he built that victory out of a very strong group, but it was definitely a lesson about internal coherence, or the exception of the lack of thereof, because I think Marc Soler had a big...
Hang on, Brian, you just mentioned Marc Soler and coherence in consecutive sentences.
I know. What's the world coming to, right? But we have to pay homage to the launch of the 26 kilometers ago launch, where Marc Soler definitely paid his tribute to internal coherence by launching Ayuso. And, you know, I don't know where you were at this point at the finish line, but it was there was genuine joy to see between the two of them at the finish line after the stage, with, you know, when Soler finally made it across the finish line himself. So in that sense, yeah, redemption or not, you know, the question is whether he needs it or not. I mean, it is an interesting thing with the situation now at UAE. You know, it's a whooping fifth stage win, you know, and they're still on second on GC. I know could they have entertained any thoughts of potentially winning the World Cup? Personally, I don't think so. So having won five stages, you know, at the halfway mark or a little bit more, it's pretty damn good, isn't it?
Yeah, and it underlined yet again what Larry certainly said a couple of days ago, that Juan Ayuso, make no mistake about it, he's a very, very good bike rider, and he wins a lot of races, and in that respect, he would be an asset to whichever team he joins. No news on that front, incidentally. Saw Giovanni Lombardi's agent this morning, but Giovanni is keeping his cards very close to his chest. There is some
Sorry, Brian, go on.
Funny thing on that, Daniel, because I wanted to ask you, you know, I was listening to one of the episodes and you said something along the lines of, you know, when you're a GC hope or when you have GC aspirations, you every time you miss the mark on that, your value drops a little bit. And I can't really tell. Has Ayuso dropped in value? Part of me tells me, I think not, in the sense that any GC rider at his age should always be measured against whatever else is on the market at that age with a winning potential. You know, with Vingegaard being the age he has, with whatever faux fatigue Pogacar has at this point. I don't think that what we've seen of Ayuso here, now that he's available, right? I'm not certain that his value has gone down. It's probably more like a psychological analysis of wherever he potentially can fit in, and if he's able to actually ride with other teammates who have GC, you know, ambitions in any context.
Yeah, if he was still on the market, which I don't think he is, and I don't think he necessarily has been in this Vuelta, I would suggest that off the bike factors have affected his value more than on the bike factors. Yeah. I would say it's pretty stable as far as on the bike factors are concerned. The other thing, Brian, I mean, we talked yesterday about wage inflation and professional cycling and why this relates to a little bit tenuously to what happened yesterday, in the sense that cycling now has to court and get into bed with a different kind of sponsor than it once did. But we've talked a lot in the last few years about the length of contracts as well as increasing wages. And you just talked there about the sort of scarcity, or you hinted at the sort of scarcity of Grand Tour leaders. Another thing that has pushed up the value, I would say, of potential Grand Tour leaders is the fact that in any given year now, there are only, well, some years there isn't even one on the market.
Yeah.
Or they're tied to these very long contracts. And this feeds into this ongoing escalation in prices, wages, demands on sponsors.
Yeah, I mean, I would say if you take Vingegaard and Pogacar out of the equation, because you kind of have to, because they are, for all intents and purposes, tied into where they are. What I think is interesting now is that the transfer, this is the second time in this season within a quite short amount of time that we've seen two very big names change teams. I think that's going to set a precedent, because one thing is that the teams are able to pay this amount of money, which is completely
an anomaly.
In professional cycling, you know, it's not, you know, I do remember Wiggins and Cancellara, because I was involved in both of those transactions of sorts. But it's not, I don't think it's going to be that uncommon in the future when teams have that type of money, you know, that they start out by signing massive talent, they pay for them, and then they eventually realize that, or the riders themselves realize that they it isn't a good match, or they can't express themselves fully towards their ambitions. At a given super team, because those are only the super teams that can afford, and then there will be these transfers, and there could even be a way of making money for those teams. You know, that's a different source of income sometimes for teams, big or small.
Yeah. Incidentally, we talked a minute ago about the redemptive quality of this victory for Juan Ayuso. He was asked in his press conference whether it was a kind of revenge, or it did represent revenge on UAE, or revenge for what happened a couple of days ago. He said that, well, maybe a little bit, but he would rather concentrate and rather talk about the joy he experienced today and positive things, as he put it. He also was asked about the World Championships. We know he certainly emphasized and re-emphasized over the last few days that his main objective here, we didn't necessarily know this at the time, but he's since told us that his main goal here was to prepare for the Worlds. And he said that the way the rest of the Vuelta is set up, it's kind of perfect for that. The sort of balance of flat stages versus mountain stages, he thinks that he will be able to come out of this Vuelta just fine, in fact, better than fine. And, well, Brian, also, in his post-race press conference. He talked about those discussions we saw with Javi Romo. Javi Romo becoming animated as they rode into the finish together. He wanted Juan Ayuso to do more of the pulling. And Ayuso said that with 5 kilometres to go, the message from the team car was that he should start to play a bit. And this pained him because he gets on well with Javi Romo and he also does not like to ride and race in this way. But ultimately, Brian, as we've said many times, the sort of, the winner is always right in professional cycling. And he was right. He was vindicated today.
Yeah, especially when you saw how close they were. I mean, he couldn't have pokered it a lot more, which would have then potentially have been caught, wouldn't they? I hope that the car, or the messages conveyed from the car, they actually realized how close they were chasing from behind. But yeah, you're absolutely right. I think he probably, even with the strength of Ayuso, probably could have pulled a little bit more and won anyways. He didn't seem to have any problems in the sprint against Romo.
Incidentally, also in Juan Ayuso news, and I know that someone in the UAE press department, shall we say, is a keen listener of the podcast and listened with some amusement to Larry's anecdote a couple of days ago about Juan Ayuso being so competitive that if, for example, he's playing FIFA, the video game, and losing, he might be on occasion inclined to simply unplug the machine, so desperately does he want to win. This led to a sort of semi-serious request on my part to UAE this morning to set up a game of FIFA between Juan Ayuso and Victor Longhelotti of Ineos Grenadiers, who we heard earlier in the Vuelta a España and we've heard before was at one time addicted to FIFA and used to play it for many hours a day, but has since got rid of all his PlayStations and all of his Xboxes because, not because he can't trust himself to play it anymore, but because...
You'd probably get him into rehab again or something.
Yeah, because he's closed that chapter in his life. Brian, also in the press conferences, Jonas Vingegaard was asked about the protest yesterday again, and he said that he didn't want to give that any more attention today because attention was what they, and it was kind of an ambiguous, they didn't exactly say who he was referring to, whether he was referring to all of the protesters, some of the protesters, but he said it gives them the attention that they don't deserve or we shouldn't give them, so he didn't really want to dwell on that topic. He also said that the plan for the Vuelta a España was for the team to ride defensively in the first 10 days. In the end, they ended up getting 2 stage victories. So as we go into a different Vuelta a España, as he characterized it, he thinks that the race changes from tomorrow. We get much steeper climbs, much harder climbs. He is very happy with where he sits and the way the team has ridden.
No, it makes perfect sense. And it's quite interesting how it's the opposite of their approach at the Tour. And they have a lot more intact team for it. And I'm quite certain that after the Asturian part of this race, the GC will... It could look the same, but the time differences will be significantly different. And I also think with the way especially Jorgensen is going, I also think that we will see other Visma riders going after stages at a later point. I think he'll be comfortably in the lead after tomorrow, in my opinion, that other possibilities will arise for his teammates.
Brian, I think what today did show once again, and we didn't really need confirmation of this, but we got it again today, was that UAE's focus is not entirely on unsettling, fatiguing Jonas Vingegaard, is it? I mean, you try to, if you reverse the roles, swap these two teams around, you cannot imagine. Maybe if Wout van Aert was here, we've seen him do it at the Tour de France, we've seen his focus at times seem as though it's very much on stage wins on certain days. But Visma Lisebike would not have Marc Soler and Juan Ayuso going in a break the day before a big mountain showdown. And really, there was nothing about their presence in that group today which would have caused Visma Lisebike any stress whatsoever. They're both so far down on general classification now, they were kind of an irrelevance for the GC battle and for Almeida.
They were probably pretty happy that they were out there burning all kinds of matches before the hardest stage of the race, potentially. I don't know what Almeida was thinking about that, but I mean, I wouldn't even say that. Yeah, Ayuso has certainly spent a fairly significant amount of strength. He'll have to rely heavily on Jay Vine tomorrow, won't he? Very heavily.
Brian, we heard from Mads Pedersen. Obviously, he's making inroads, continues to make inroads on the points or in the points competition, but the stage win that he came for continues to elude him. No obvious way in which he could have prevented a Juan Ayuso victory today. He's clearly finding his legs, as he said in that interview. We're starting to see the Mads Pedersen that we saw in the Giro d'Italia with his sort of virtuoso rides where he attacks and then he counters and he's in multiple moves in the course of a single stage. But yes, as I said, the stage win that he came for and Trek came for continues to elude him.
Yeah, and he's running out of options, of course, but then again, there's always Madrid. You know, there's always that one possibility, and he would certainly be upset if he were to win that jersey without a stage win to, you know, to add to it. But it's not for the lack of trying, that's for sure.
Brian, it's time, I think, for today's Encuentro del Día. As I explained yesterday, the running theme of this week, the recurring theme of this week, is riders who are doing their first Grand Tour. Now, yesterday we had, who did we have yesterday, Brian? Oh, we had Liam Slock, who, if I'm not mistaken, was in that big move, that 52-man move again today. And the previous day, we'd had Johannes Stauner-Mittet. So for the third installment of this mini-series, we are going to hear my conversation this morning with Lucas Nerurka, who's an intriguing rider, 21 years old, born in Cornwall in the United Kingdom, but grew up somewhere else, as you're about to find out. And he has a famous father. Brian, do you know much about his famous father?
No, I don't. Enlighten me.
Semi-famous. Famous if you were in the United Kingdom in sort of late 80s, early 90s, and you watched athletics. Richard Nerurka, Lucas's father, was one of the best, well, certainly in the top two or three best long-distance runners, track athletes of the late 80s, I would say, early 90s. I'm just bringing up his...
That was actually around when I was following athletics quite a bit.
There you go. And, well, he competed for Great Britain in European Championships, World Championships, Olympic Games, indeed. He was fifth in the marathon in Atlanta. In the World Cup marathon in San Sebastian in Spain in 1993, he was first. I think his best time in marathon was around about 2 hours 10. Anyway, Lucas Nerurka is the son of that illustrious father. Speaking of which, Brian, another great ride today from Markel Bellocchi, yeah, who was in the 52-man break, and sort of surreally I saw after the finish being interviewed by his father, who is working for Bass Television here. They had a formal interview and then they had a sort of off-mic debrief as well. But another good ride from Markel Bellocchi. Anyway, Brian, finally, we're going to get to this morning's Encuentro del Día with Lucas Nerurka, who is 21 years old and riding his first Grand Tour here at the Vuelta a España.
El Encuentro del Día, the meeting of the day.
Well, Lucas, this week I'm sort of doing a bit of a tour of first-time Grand Tourists, guys who are doing their first Grand Tour.
Yeah.
First question, how's it going?
Yeah, it's going well. I think I don't really know what to expect, especially in the second week. It's most days of racing I've done. But I'm starting to feel a bit better now. I had a few days where I was really struggling, and then yesterday I was like feeling a bit more myself, so happy with that.
What were you told to expect, or what had you been sort of led to believe that you should expect from your first Grand Tour? Or what were the sort of horror stories, and what do you have doubts about?
I think the most intimidating thing is when you get to day 7, 8, 9 and you're like already pretty tired, and then you're like, you can't look too far ahead. It really is a case of just like one day at a time. And after I had that rest day, and then now it feels a lot like the days are going a bit faster. You're in the routine, and I'm enjoying it now, yeah.
You've got a couple of Markel, who's standing next to us, he's the son of a famous father, successful athlete. You are as well. I asked him the other day, what was his relationship with his father's career? How much he knew about it, how much his father tells him about it. In your case, what's your relationship with your dad's successful athletics career?
Yeah, I mean, I like to ask him about it because, it's just interesting to, to compare and see what the differences were from, I mean, both in different sports and sort of different eras as well. I mean, it was, it was completely different sport back then. A lot less professional, but, I mean, like, the fundamentals of sport are the same. You train hard, you work hard, and, you compete as best you can, so, yeah.
Does he volunteer many opinions about what you should be doing, how you should be training?
No, he's always, like, stayed out of it. I think he realises it's, it is a different sport to running, and also he knows now, especially on this team, that I'm, like, very well supported, so he doesn't really have to stay involved. But even when I was a junior, he would always take quite back foot, because I was always quite interested in keeping it, doing what I wanted. And, he knew, I mean, if I wanted help, I would ask him, but he wouldn't just say anything for no reason.
And... I think this is connected to your father's past as well. You spent part of your childhood in Ethiopia, is that right?
Yeah.
Can you just tell me about how that came about and, how you reflect on that time?
Yeah, I mean, it came about because I think when my dad was competing, he spent a lot of time in Kenya and Ethiopia, and he made lots of friends in Ethiopia. So then even when he retired, he still wanted to be part of the running culture in Ethiopia, so he set up Great Ethiopian Run, and my mum also found a job out there, and then I loved it. I have some memories. I was only 7 when I left, but
ages what to 7?
From when I was born to when I was 7. So it's a long time, and it's quite an influential time in your life. I have some really fond memories, and I've been back twice. And I really like going back, and I just really like following the Ethiopian running scene as well.
I think you're good friends and occasional training partner with Skarbu Gumai, aren't you? Obviously the first Ethiopian to ride the Tour de France.
Yeah, I mean, he really helped me along my way when I first moved to Girona, and even before I moved to Girona, I had a trip and I stayed with him, and I mean, all the advice he's given me has been really, really helpful. And I mean, his story and how he came world tour is just amazing. I mean, it makes like my journey and probably most Europeans seem pretty trivial. And it's amazing how casually he almost talks about his experience when, most people would, that would be like completely mind-boggling.
Your journey was obviously different. We'll get on to another sort of big biographical bit of trivia now. I believe that you got 4 A-stars at A-level, is that right?
Yeah, I did.
So you had other paths available to you, I suppose. Did you consider them seriously?
Yeah, I did. I mean, I didn't really know you could make much of a career out of cycling until I met guys in VCL like Tom Glogue, and then they were 2 years above me, and they were in the same position as me, debating between university and cycling, and for me, at least, I made the decision because I could always go back to university, or I could at least try to go back to university, but I mean, it seemed silly to miss out on such a good opportunity with Trinity Racing at the time to try and step up pro.
What would you have studied?
I was going to study physics, yeah.
Maybe in your mid-30s you can become a more mature student after a glittering cycling career. Well, last question I'm going to ask you then, Lucas, is what is your ultimate dream in professional cycling?
Good question. I think if I could win any race in the world, it would be world champs. I think to have the strides for a year, and I just think it's so cool, especially so different from the other races representing your country. So that would be the dream race to win.
This year too early, because obviously first Worlds on the continent of Africa would kind of be appropriate, but is it a bit too early this year?
Yeah, I think it's a bit too early this year, especially coming off Welter. I think I need a few weeks to recover from this.
Well, Brian, that was Lucas Nuraka, 4 A-star student in A-levels. Obviously a clever young lad and also a very fine rider. He hasn't had too many opportunities yet to show what he can do
in the Vuelta a España, but certainly, well, he's a fast finisher when the road goes uphill in the last few kilometres. A puncher, very much a distinguished puncher in the making, I would suggest. Brian, I did say at the start of the episode that we might briefly return to the subject of yesterday's protest, pro-Palestine protest. And I really just had one question that even before recording today, I was curious to ask you, and it related to the UCI statement last night, which I read, I read out an extract, shall we say. I read out the salient points earlier in the episode. And of course, you used to work in communications. Now your main gig is as a journalist, but you've sat on both sides of the great divide, shall we say. You used to work in communications for teams. And just the one thing I would say about that statement from the UCI last night, in light of what happened yesterday, was that it struck me as too generic. And there is such a thing in, I don't know if there's a term for this, Brian, but in communications there's a certain type of language which gives the reader the strong impression that the author of the, whoever's putting out the statement, is not really engaging with the issue, and they are going through the motions of saying what they expect people, or they think people want to hear or expect to hear.
Yeah, I mean, I would often recommend people, when they read press releases, to think about what it doesn't say. You know, that, and I think in the case of the specific one last night, is they're just sort of passing the ball to avoid being held ultimately responsible. They're just referring to the IOC. They're referring to an Olympic standpoint or standpoint that the IOC would take, saying that, you know, ultimately sport and politics shouldn't be such and such, but they're sort of shying away from their ultimate position, which is the governing body of cycling, and which is also in this situation the ultimate authority on the Vuelta. You know, it's, if there were to be any doubt on what was supposed to be happening, the Vuelta, you know, Unipublic or the ASO would go to the UCI for any clarification about what was going on. And in this case, the UCI just kind of wash their hand on the situation. And that, I think, is, you know, that they obviously felt that they needed to send out something, but it's just calling it a nothing burger is probably too strong. But if there's any meat to that burger, it's of a very, very tiny, yeah, sliced one.
Yeah, there's an opaqueness to it. And I even said to you before we started recording, they referred yesterday, I think, to the circumstances that, or they condemned the circumstances, or they condemned the events that led to the neutralization. Well, I kind of think it would have been useful to specify exactly what those events were that they were talking about. You know, it's obviously a difficult issue. It's a difficult issue for them to negotiate as well. And they've set up the World Tour, which is the very sort of, it's the foundation of the top level of the sport. Now, you can't just send people home willy-nilly. And it's sort of easier said than done to just tell Israel to go home and we'll see you again at the next race. But by being present and showing that you are open to dialogue and that you want to be as transparent as possible on the ground, I think it's really important in this instance. Brian, we shall now talk about tomorrow's stage, which some, I guess, will call the Queen's Stage, to the Angliru.
La etapa de mañana, la cena de ayer. Tomorrow's stage, yesterday's food.
Brian, last night's dinner, we were in a place called Liendo on the Cantabrian coast, or just inland from the Cantabrian coast. Although we were in Cantabria, I had a cachopo, which is an Asturian speciality, which is a bit of an eyesore of a dish, or some people would consider it a bit of an eyesore of a dish. An enormous paving slab of meat, veal usually, in breadcrumbs, with ham around the veal and cheese around the ham, and then breadcrumbs around the ham. I think I've got that in the right order.
A lot of meat for you.
But yeah, it is a lot of meat for me. It's a lot of meat for anyone, Brian. And it is traditionally served in Asturias. And
it's seen as a sort of feather in a restaurant's cap if they can serve the biggest cacioppo around. So they'll try to sort of outdo each other in the size of the cacioppo they serve. Anyway, it wasn't sophisticated, Brian. It was a bit of a blunt instrument, but I did quite enjoy it nonetheless. A guilty pleasure, shall we say. Anyway, we are in Asturias tomorrow. We are really, truly in Asturias tomorrow. And we are going back to the Angliru. The race last visited the Angliru in 2023. That was the day, the famous day of the betrayal. Primoz Roglic's betrayal of Sepp Kuss, who at that point was leading the Vuelta a España. Let's just remind ourselves of that, Brian, by hearing what Primoz Roglic said after he had claimed the stage victory that day. And then after that, you're going to hear Sepp Kuss talking at the finish line today about the secret of riding well on the Angliru.
Definitely, I have to say, I mean, it's a strange feeling, if I'm honest, I still continue to ride. But yeah, it's immediately, yes, either you go completely all in or not. But yeah, for me, it was a big wish to win on Angliru. And yeah, I'm happy I did it. Because yeah, I mean, you're obviously dropping your teammate in Areda, and I spoke to him. I mean, keep believing, keep fighting, the way I went or I did. Yes, it was now really a guy on guy. And what I want to say is my responsibility. He's the first guy that I want to win this Vuelta. But yes, my responsibility is also, yes, to do my best if I'm here. And yeah, then the road will tell us. But yeah, for the moment, it's Sweet Worries, who is first, second, third.
Yeah, it's just kind of about pacing it. I mean, the hardest part, the Cuenca de Cabras, is obviously super steep, but yeah, it's such a steep climb that you can't really surprise anybody there. You just have to ride as hard as you can. So I think it's pretty simple in that sense.
Do you expect Jonas to win there?
Oh, you never know what to expect. I mean, this Vuelta, it's been pretty close most days. There's a lot of guys that are surprising and riding well. You never know, but I mean, of course, we have a lot of confidence in Jonas, and it's a climb that's really perfect for him.
Brian, do you have the profile in front of you for tomorrow's stage?
I do.
Can you tell us what we have in store?
Yeah, well, first of all, Daniel, it's a long old stage. It's a 203-kilometer stage with basically all of the climbing in the last 50 kilometers. There's an uncategorized climb coming before the first categorized climb that has its peak, the first categorized climb, category one climb, the Alto de Mosqueta, and it's a 6.4 kilometer at 8.2, already a hard climb. It's a long descent to the first sprint, and then it goes up the Alto de Cordal, which I think features often when before the Angliru, right? Yep. And after that, quick descent, and then it's the hell of all climbs, I suppose, the Angliru. 12.4 kilometers at almost a 10% average. You've ridden that, haven't you?
Yes, I have ridden. Not with any great distinction, Brian, but
not a lot of journalists have actually ridden that.
No.
I think.
No. But Brian, we shall not see me riding up the Angliru tomorrow, I don't think. I don't think there's time for
but
that.
But can I just say, like, I think this would be interesting for the listeners. As a journalist, what would the logistics for you be tomorrow? Like, how do you get to the top? Or do you get to the top at all?
Yes, we are. We are driving to the top tomorrow. Only certain members of the press corps are allowed to go to the top. Well, we have to sort of pull... carpool tomorrow. We have to have, I think it's a minimum of three people in the car to get up to the top, to get a special sticker to go up the top. And there are always problems on the Angliru with cars because it is so steep in parts that clutches blow out. And it can be, particularly if it's wet, it can be a little bit hairy, shall we say, getting up there. There can be some nerve-wracking moments, particularly on the steeper sections. I'm just going to look at the weather forecast for tomorrow. I don't think... it's going to be too bad. In fact, I think we've got sun forecast for tomorrow, which is unusual on the Anglidal. We've had
a lot of finishes
up there where visibility has been a problem. Even the last time with Sepp Kuss and Primoz Roglic, visibility was a problem. Brian, quickly, because we've got to wrap up, I expect Jonas Vingegaard to win tomorrow and to take significant time out of his main rivals for GC victory. It's going to be really interesting to see how Tom Pidcock goes, because we had that that really impressive ride from him yesterday in the stage that never was. But he's sort of untested riding in this exalted company on such a difficult climb.
Yeah, he'll be. I think he'll be going well tomorrow, and he's someone I think also rides a lot on the confidence that he's found now. He seems more focused than I've seen him before in a Grand Tour. But almost like, but the big question mark is how UAE will approach this stage, because it's inevitable that a group will go, and it won't last until the end. But a group will go. I think it will be too difficult, or it will be unnecessary for Jumbo to control it all day. And there will be UAE riders. There'll probably also be maybe one Visma rider in that group. Who knows? But I'll be very curious to see the approach for UAE on this stage. They obviously have a lot of knowledge, local knowledge also around the architecture of this stage. So yeah, I think we're in for a real belter.
We certainly are, Brian. We'll be back tomorrow evening to analyse the action, hoping that I've got internet coverage up on the Anglirú and we can actually record an episode. I'm sure we will somehow. We will fudge something. Anyway, Brian, until then, buenas tardes.
Buenas tardes, Daniel.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Byrne.